Like you said, you started BBSs in the early 80s. Now, was there a certain kind of BBS software or a specific BBS that you thought really influenced you at the beginning?
Not at the beginning. I mean, the one I liked was RBBS, and later on when I ran my own, I started with RBBS, and then somebody convinced me to switch to QuickBBS, and that was a lot better, and that was the one that really got me interested in programming, I guess. Not just using the BBS, but I actually tried to write my own after that.
Did you end up writing your own?
And didn't finish it. I think everyone started their own and never finished it.
Is there a, I mean, so in terms of, I mean, RBBS, is RBBS and or QuickBBS the quintessential BBS to you? I mean, those PC ANSI supported 80 column BBSs?
Yeah, probably QuickBBS for the public domain boards. You know, all the pirate boards ran Celerity, or they were all the Emulex hacks, it seems like.
Did you keep track of any of the ANSI groups that were going by and stuff like that?
Not really. I mean, I remember what ACID and that's the only one I can remember.
There was like ACID and ICE is the other big
Ice,
one.
right. Yeah, it's all coming back.
Yeah. Well, there's ACID, ICE, Tribe, there's, and but the problem is what I find is that it tends to be ACID and ICE and
Yeah.
and there were like 200 other groups, but never got that name recognition.
Yeah.
There really seems to be like almost a template for how your BBS has to be, in terms of like, it's got to have a dark adjective and a dark noun. So it's got to be Forbidden Castle or Lost Cavern or damaged,
Yeah. Well, there was all the toxic wasteland type boards, and there was one called Festering Pit of Vile Excretions. Those were the pirate boards, I think.
One of the things that's really lost is how much time you spend on your BBS, like trying to make it work. I mean,
Oh,
just
God, yeah.
here are hours of it.
Yeah, I remember I spent, when I set up QuickBBS, I spent, I think, the whole summer staying up all night, every night, playing on the same REM tape over and over all summer. Finally got it up and running. Actually, it was running the whole time. I just was making it look better and working on the ANSI and doing all that stuff.
I asked this in a different way, but I mean, is there a specific BBS in your past outside of your own that you think really has an influence on you, or that's a particular favorite that you are always trying to get on?
Nah, there's not a certain one that comes to mind. There were some that were hard to get on, like the Lexicon was one of the big pirate boards. I think they only had two lines or so, but I can't think of any particular one. They were all hard to get on, all the good ones.
Did
I do
any?
remember though that we found out a trick when this is later when I was into hacking. There was a Southwestern Bell system called DATU where I could call up phone number and enter. It was a Southwestern Bell lineman used this to access lines. And if a bulletin board was busy, I could call this up and enter that bulletin board's phone number, and it would cause the line quality to go so bad that it would drop carrier. So then I could get in. So that was my way of getting into boards that were busy.
The pirate BBSs, especially now that pirating has taken on essentially the same quality of pervasiveness as dope smoking, essentially now it's something that everybody does and won't talk about, and there's a few every year who get whacked, and then there's the other millions who are just like, oh, well, bad for him. back then, it's a different kind of environment, really. I mean, just the relative scarcity of them and the amount of time spent. I don't know if you had any thoughts or opinions on what, you know, the difference of, like, pirate boards of the past, like, what it was like.
I mean, I haven't kept up with the pirate scene. I mean, I'm a consumer now, more not a producer.
Well, I mean, the mid-80s kind of BBSs, you know, mid-80s, early 90s BBSs. Right.
I mean, you know, you had the crackers, the couriers, the suppliers. I guess you have all that today. You know, I was a cracker for a short while, and then a courier, and then, you know, eventually moved on to from the pirating to the freaking, and then to the hacking. So pirating was just kind of a short phase, I guess, on the road to hacking.
Now, when you wrote Tone Loc is significantly better than what comes before it. I mean, I attended a word dialing talk in, it was 2002. I attended a word driving talk, sorry, word dialing talk,
mm-hmm.
that covered, and one of his main themes was, you should use Tone Loc, because it's the only good one. And this is when I first encountered Tone Loc. I mean, did you have an inspiration for doing this program?
Mm-hmm. It started off, I was actually went through another phase kind of after pirating and right before freaking of voicemail box hacking. And there was a voicemail box, a voicemail system that had an administration box and had a 4-digit password on it. And I was trying to hack this box. So I wrote this program called Boxer that just tried all the 4-digit codes. And it would let me listen to it on the modem while it hacked. And that program, later I modified it and turned it into Tone Loc, so it would dial scanning for PBXs and modems. So that's how it started. It wasn't even a word dialer, it was something else. And then I first used it for, actually just for getting PBXs, which you could use to call free long distance and freaking and stuff like that. Then I added the ability to scan for modems, you know, as I got more into hacking. And eventually that's all I used it for, mm-hmm. the modems.
Did you get much, I mean, it was more difficult back then than it is now, but I mean, do you remember any of the feedback you got from people? Or people using it in ways you didn't expect, or?
Yeah, I remember I first gave it to my friends so we could all use it to hack PBXs. And then somebody sent it to one of the pirate boards, and that's how it started to get popular. Was the couriers back then needed to have long distance code so they could call long distance and send all these wares everywhere. So they started using it to hack PBXs, and, you know, just got more and more popular. And I heard people would use it through when you could scan for modems, they would want to scan an area that wasn't local to them. So they would actually get on an internet out dial, which lets you access a modem in another part of the country or the world through the internet for free. And they would scan through the internet using this remote modem. That was one cool idea. Let's see, one person used it to register for a class at UT Austin. They have a phone system where you call up and dial, you know, codes, and you dial the class you want to add, and the class was full. And he really wanted to get in, so he programmed Tone Loc to just keep trying over and over until the class opened up, and he finally got it. What else? There was another. Oh, yeah. Someone used it for kind of to harass somebody. They programmed Tone Loc to call up a pager prefix and page 10,000 people to one person's phone number. And so that person started getting calls for starting right away for, like, 2 weeks on their phone just from being paged by everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the weird things people have used it for.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about it, I mean, is that it persists as a admired tool. I mean, did you know about, how do I put it? it seems like a lot of programming experience went into it. I mean, certainly your graphical representation of exchanges is, you know, highly touted.
That's, I have to give credit to Mucho Moss for that. That was totally his idea. And that was one of his big contributions to Tonal Oak. I guess let me give some history on how he came in. I'd written Tonal Oak, and something happened. I lost the source code. You know, my hard drive crashed or something. So I stopped working on it, and he came across it and liked it, and he wanted to add some more features to it. So he asked me, you know, if he could work on it. I told him, yeah, but I lost the source, and I don't want to rewrite it. So he offered to rewrite it and bring it back up to where it was. And he did that, and then we both started working on it together from then on. So, you know, that's why the tone look you see now says Minor Threat Mucho Moss. Mm-hmm. And he came up with the tone map, the graphical representation, which was one of the cool things about it. So, yeah.
Okay. Was there, I mean, as you said, it was uploaded to a pirate board. I mean, did you find, I mean, even though you're uploading it to a relatively obscure set of boards, I mean, did you find it coming back to you in strange places? Like running into it where you didn't expect it, or running into it?
I started seeing it on all the pirate boards. You know, every board would have Tonal Oak eventually. And then later, when the internet, you know, came around 93 or 94, it was on some internet sites, hacking sites. And yeah, the last version we actually released was in September of 94. And that's the version that's still out there today.
If you had to describe the kind of boards that you were on in the early 90s, I mean, you know, how would you describe them?
In the early 90s, like 90 to 91, there were still a few public domain boards I was on, kind of moved toward the hacking boards. And then 91, 92, more into the hacking, freaking boards. But only a couple of those, you know, I just picked about two or three that I liked and just stuck to those. So I wasn't on like all the boards or anything.
Well, what made them good versus the others?
Just the people on it. I mean, that's what makes a board good, I think, is, you know, it didn't matter what they're running. I don't even remember what they're running, but the message groups, you know, people who you can meet, because, I mean, through, like, Scantronics was on board, I remember. I think it was from San Diego, maybe. Ran by a guy named Kludge. And through that board, I made a couple of good friends that I ended up, you know, doing a lot of hacking stuff with later.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a... The pirate BBSs at that point, and certainly, I mean, you know, quote-unquote the underground BBSs, had a kind of a standoffish relationship with all the professional boards and all the public domain boards and all the others. I mean, do you have any memories of that, of like, you know, keep that off here, you know, keep our number out of the hands of the kids, and, mm-hmm. you know, don't let anyone know where we are and stuff?
Well, yeah, they all wanted to be secret and elite, you know. A lot of boards, pirate boards, had a PD front. So they look like a public domain board. And if you had special access, then it was actually a pirate board. One of my friends ran Opus BBS, which nobody ran a pirate board off Opus, but he actually ran a PD board. But if you had high enough access, you got onto the pirate board, and it looked totally different. A lot of pirate boards were designed to look like some obscure system, like an old Unix system or whatever. And then once you log in, you know, you get the pirate board. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's special passwords to get in. And just to get access, you might have to answer some questions, like, what does Cosmos stand for? Or, you know, something like that. I remember when I first got on Scantronics, I was going through the questionnaire and had to answer some hacking questions. And the sysop, Kludge, just chatted me, and I forgot what he said, but he gave me access right away for some reason. Might have been Tonal Oak, I don't remember.
If you had to describe what it was like, you know, what it was like to be on an underground board, you know, like, how did it feel, you know, like, how did it, you know, what was the, I guess, what environment like? You know, I mean, what was the tone of the posting or the people? And...
Well, I guess that what made them really useful, other than meeting, you know, just other hackers and people you heard about and stuff, was if you were scanning, for example, with ToneLook, whatever, you found a system that you didn't recognize, you would post like what it looked like, post a login prompt, and somebody else on there would have already come across it and figure the whole system out and know, you know, the default passwords and know how to run it. So you could post that and somebody would respond and give you the full deal. Maybe there's already a text file on it, you know. So that was really useful. You could read through the message groups of other people's scans. There was a whole message forum called Scans. And, you know, if you recognize a system that they found, you could help them out the same way. So that was one useful thing.
Now, going by your age, you were on these at a relatively young age. Certainly mm-hmm. the earlier BBSs in the mid-80s, you're very young. And even these, you're pretty young. Did you find that they... Did you find yourself gravitating to the boards with other young people, or was it just whoever happened to be there? I mean, you know.
Yeah, I don't really care about the age. I mean, I think most people were a little bit older than me. My pirate friends were actually about a year younger, but the hacker people were a little bit older, it seemed like.
Do you think there's a reason why it attracts younger as opposed to just anybody?
Well, when you're 15 and 14, you don't have a car, you don't have a girlfriend, you got nothing but time, right? Especially during the summer, no school. So you've literally got, you know, 18 hours a day to just explore, you know, programming or hacking or whatever. So I think that's why you see these kids, 15-year-old kids, you know, in Europe hacking DVDs. I mean, thank God for those kids, right? Because they don't have anything better to do. No car, no girlfriend. And that's just what they do. And then once they get a car and a girlfriend, 17, 18, and, you know, they don't have as much time left to do that stuff.
Did you find that the case with yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, a lot of this stuff happened. I mean, at least I was old enough to drive, but, you know, and I had to work and go to school. So I had less time, but, you know, I didn't really get into... Ever since I had seen War Games, of course, I was interested in hacking, but I never met anybody, no other hackers, until, you know, 1990 or so. So I was like 18 or 19 by the time I started meeting other people who were interested in it.
Now, the time between War Games and writing a war dialer is a significant period of time, almost 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wrote ToneLook in 1991, the first version, and War Games, like, 83, I guess it came out. So, I mean, there were plenty of war dialers, obviously. There was, oh God, what were they? Do you remember?
I forgot now. Well, there's Fortune 500.
Yeah, the old ones. Yeah, there's one in, like, BASIC, I'm trying to remember the name. But anyway, yeah, none of them, they work, kind of, but... They did, you know, none of them did random scanning, for one. That was what ToneLook did differently. And none of them were as configurable as I wanted, so.
Yeah, certainly you have all these features that you pack into it. I mean, was this your first time you'd written something like this, where you'd said, here's a function that exists with computers, and I'm going to write a program that does that function even better and more configured? Or had there been other practice programs you'd written?
I had written some public domain software for some little utilities for QuickBBS, really small, stupid things. But this was, yeah, that was the first big one. You know, I'd started writing that BBS, and I learned C doing that, and then ToneLook was in C, and I got better at C writing ToneLook. So, but yeah, that was the first big program that I'd written.
With running your own BBS, which is when? Is that in the early 80s as well? Or is it much later?
Yeah, no, it's... Okay, so I called my first BBS in 1984. Mm-hmm. And course, then I wanted my own. So I was living with my dad. We had one phone line, and I set up a BBS. And as soon as calls started coming in, my dad's trying to answer the phone. It's like, well, you know, I told him I was running a BBS, so he made me take it down, obviously. So that didn't work. So I couldn't run a BBS again until 1988. I put up my board, and I had just my own phone line at that point. So that was, yeah, that was my first, my own BBS. I ran that for about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember the name?
Atlantis. It was the PD board.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any strong memories about Atlantis?
I mean, I learned a lot doing it. You know, that I got in, I had been doing basic programming all along, but that I got into more programming like Pascal and C at that point. I got more interested in networking. My board was a FireNet board, and so I got interested in email and all that stuff that, you know, I didn't even know about before. Nothing, you know, the board wasn't anything spectacular, just your average board. It had Trade Wars on it, and people played that all the time. So, yeah.
Now, I assume your board, your time, is this how predates Legend of the Red Dragon? Or is that the same time, too?
Legend, what is that? I don't even...
Well, there you go. Okay. It's a role-playing game. It is the single most common thing I am asked about related to BBSs of like, oh, you're going to cover Legend of the Red Dragon, right? It's essentially a role-playing game that has very well-done ANSI screens. Created by Seth Abel, whose real name turns out to be Seth Abel Robinson, and I think it dates to 91, 92.
Oh, okay.
And
that was probably after my time in PD land.
Yeah, I mean, it just becomes, like, the most beloved thing. But, you know, you have a lot of cases of that, of, like, these very shared experiences over just a few programs, which is, like I said, why I was so interested when, you know, I was able to get in contact with the author of Tome Loc, because Tome Loc represents for a lot of kids their first real, I mean, it's a tool that does this magical thing for you, right? It's like it's a thing you put on your computer that finds other computers. And that's a pretty major deal. Did you have any competition at that point?
No, I mean, competition came around later, I think. Like, there's one called THC Scan, I think. That's a newer one. I think it might be Windows-based. Tome Loc's DOS-based. So people think DOS, you know, oh my God. But it actually runs under Linux, too, if you want. There's some commercial ones. There's, like, Phone Sweep, if you wanted to pay $10,000 for it. It did the same thing as Tome Loc, but it wasn't written by a hacker. So, yeah, it's worth $10,000, right?
Again, this is one. Do you have any strong opinions on that perception of hackers and underground BBSs? Because certainly by the early 90s, they're really being demonized until the internet shows up to take the heat away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did you have any thoughts on that?
Nothing that, you know, that hasn't already been said before. I mean, the media, you know, they're going to do what they want. They have their own agenda. And some of the people who interviewed me, or at least one of the people, told me directly, because I was asking him, hey, I'm trying to fight this case. I have a First Amendment argument when I was banned from the internet. And he's like, well, you know, I can cover that, but you have to understand journalists are not your agent. You know, we have our own agenda, and you never know what's going to happen at the end. Never know what's the spin's going to be. You know, so, I mean, that's no surprise to a lot of people, but to people who, you know, maybe hackers who've gotten in trouble and they are faced with the media trying to interview them, I guess that is a surprise to them when the thing comes out on TV or in the magazine. Mm-hmm. And it looks different from what they expected.
You know, is there anything about hacker BBSs that you think hasn't really come out in terms of, like, you know, aspects of using it or what it was like that you think just doesn't get covered because it's not interesting enough?
Hmm. Like the old hacker boards, you mean? Like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's too obscure an open a question is a perfectly valid answer, by the way.
Yeah, I just, it's been so long, I haven't, you know, it's been 10 years really since hacker boards, so.
Certainly. I mean, that's, you know, that's all part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have any particularly strong memories, good ones or bad ones, from that time that you still remember?
I mean, going to the hacker conventions, that wasn't really directly related to the bulletin boards, but all the same people you knew from the boards, you finally could meet them, you know, in person. So that was fun. And, you know, get drink and do crazy things.
Which cons?
The first one I went to was Christmas Con or Ho-Ho Con, because it was right in Houston, close enough. And then went to Summer Con, and then the next Christmas Con. That's all I've ever been to. I never been to Hope or DEF CON or any of those.
Well, and they really are different animals, by the way.
Well, now there's 2,000 people.
5,000, that's the thing.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest one I ever went to was, I think, 200 or 300 people.
Mm-hmm. And the summer cons are still going on, actually.
Are they?
Yeah.
Yeah, they used to be like 20 people, you know, invite only. I think I went to one that was actually invite only, but there were still like 100 people there.
Big invitations.
Yeah.
In describing those, what was the need to go? You know, what made you say, yeah, why not? I'll go to this thing.
Well, Ho-Ho Con was so close that I couldn't not go. It was 200 miles away, you know, Houston. And there was going to be people there from the boards I'd been calling that I'd never met. I'd really hadn't met any other hackers in person. Most of my friends local to me were more of the pirate type, wares dudes. And all the hacker people I knew were in other cities. So this was a chance to meet them in person. And, you know, after that, some of these people I started, you know, working more with on hacking things and all kinds of things.
Let's see. As a sysop, like you said, it was a relatively short time. But were you ever asked to co-sysop on other boards?
I don't think so. Not that I can think of.
I mean,
it wouldn't be a big deal because if you weren't a sys, if you didn't have your own board, it was a big deal to be a co-sys or a co-sysop. I don't know. It was neat, I guess, but. If you already had your own board, who cares about another board, you know?
Did you have any... And again, answer as much as you want to remember or care to, but I mean, were you aware when the Sun Devil busts start happening and when... I mean, certainly in the early 90s, a lot of boards are just now starting to be seized,
yeah,
and busted and removed and taken down. Do you have memories from that time?
No, that was, I think it was 1990, at least the Austin raids, and that was just before I got into the scene. So I didn't know about it when it happened. I knew about it, you know, a year or two later, you know, the Steve Jackson Games raid, and I met, you know, some of the Austin people. Eric Bloodaxe was in Austin, and I guess that was the main one who I met. But yeah, it was before my time, before I was into hacking, really.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that hacking and freaking BBSs were an important part or a side effect with BBSs? Do you have in the scheme of things as you knew it, I mean, do you think they were?
Well, BBSs were just the way to meet other hackers. That was the main point. You know, hacking by yourself, like I said, I was interested for like 6 years or more. You know, I didn't know what to do. I mean, I tried things, I scanned and I found some HP 3000 system. I had no idea what it was. I tried everything. I probably spent weeks on that system when, meanwhile, you know, probably 5 miles away, you have the mentor who knew everything about the system, but I didn't know the mentor. And I remember I'd print out of the system to somebody at school who was on a hacker board, and he posted it and got a response from somebody on the board with a printout on exactly how to hack it. And I was reading the message, and it was from the mentor. I didn't know who he was at that time, but years later I realized, hey, that's, you know, same guy. So, I mean, I think that was the main, you know, things. BBSs were just a way to meet other people so you could learn about the systems you're trying to hack, you know, and download text files, download FRAC, read about the system, you know, you found scanning.
Do you remember reading Mentor's Conscience of a Hacker?
Yeah. I remember that. It was all caps, wasn't it?
Maybe one of the copies you got.
Okay. It might have been converted, but yeah, I remember that.
What were your memories of it?
That was before I was had really done any hacking, but I think it just made me want to be a hacker more after reading it. I mean, it was, you know, I could relate to it.
Mm-hmm. What do you think makes a good BBS?
I think mostly just the, you know, the people on it. I mean, in the end, there were cool boards that had cool ANSI and, you know, 10 lines and 300 gigs or whatever. I guess it was 300 megs back then, right? I mean, some of the best boards were just, you know, the cheesy software. I don't even know what they're running. It might have been black and white, you know, but the people on it, you know, the content, the messages, yeah, that was, to me, what made a good board.
Did you end up affiliating with any groups?
Pirate groups. Yeah, like when I was going through the pirate thing, I was with a group called Public Enemy. They were kind of, they were mostly Canadians, and then most, like half in Canada and half in Austin, I think, and people spread around. Mm-hmm. And I started out, I didn't have a fast enough modem to be a courier, so I started just cracking games, and then did some couriering, but that wasn't really interesting, so that was it, and just my little phase through hacking.
Yeah, I mean...
Pirating.
I mean, when... certainly by the early 90s, when you start having pirating, it's on a whole different scale than the others. I mean, I don't know if you ever ran into this phenomenon, the four-pay bolt, the four-pay pirate BBSs that were, like, a lot of money to be on.
Yeah. No, I mean... I couldn't understand why anybody would pay, but apparently they were out there. I do remember one thing. This is sometime 1988 to 1990 when I was into the public domain scene. I had the public domain board, FidoNet, all that. And, you know, we had these monthly CTSA, Central Texas SysOps Association meetings. And Southwestern Bell was doing something where... Because when you were a sysop and you had a phone line, it was used 24 hours a day because you know, your board was always busy. So you're paying $15 a month for this phone line. But most people, they buy a phone line, they pay $15 a month, they don't use it that much per day. So Southwestern Bell was trying to charge more money for sysop, for people who are on boards, even though the deal was you buy a phone line, you can use it as much as you want. And so the sysops... ganged up and formed this thing called COSAR that was against that, and we did things like they had International Pulse Dial Month. I don't know how international it really was, but the thing was, it costs Southwestern Bell less money to process touch tones than it does to process pulse. Do you remember pulse dialing? Some people may not, but they would charge more for it, right? So what the sysops did, they agreed for the whole month, whatever month it was, to use nothing but pulse dialing and to try to convince all their users to also do the same, to overload Southwestern Bell's circuits, just to prove that, you know, it costs you more to process pulse dialing than it does for touch tone. So that was like a little battle against, you know, the man.
Were you a member of COSAR?
Well, yeah, COSAR wasn't really official. You didn't have to join or anything, but I did the, you know, pulse dialing thing. I was a member of the CTSA.
I do know the COSAR thing. The common belief is that the reason that they were actually going after sysops was because they were going to implement a version of Minitel and that they perceived that bulletin boards were a direct competition.
Okay.
Direct threat. So their theory was, let's destroy it or price it out of existence and get rid of them. Mm-hmm. And so they did this crazy thing. And then this lawyer starts COSAD.
Okay.
And it gets huge, and they back off that, and there's articles about them, and, yeah. and insulting stuff, and yeah, and that ultimately they do back off. It's one of the major triumphs, because a lot of the announcement goes over FidoNet, you know,
yeah.
to do it.
Right.
Did you keep track much of the FidoNet politics?
Kind of, well, I mean, yeah, those people, they just love the drama, it seemed like, because I guess FidoNet, I guess the internet was around, I didn't know anything about it, but kind of parallel to FidoNet, except FidoNet was using all modems, and, you know, you had the Echo and Mail, and, you know, the local FidoNet people, they met, you know, I was part of that, and I don't know, it was just very political, it seemed like. Like, the guy who was the hub for Austin, he had total control. It was like a dictatorship. And if he didn't like you, you weren't going to get your mail. You know, there's nothing you could do. Mm-hmm. And he ended up, you know, not liking me much after a while. So, you know, I eventually, my board went down for about a month. And you have a node number, which is like your identity, kind of like your domain nowadays. And he assigned my node number to somebody else pretty quickly, you know, which he was allowed to do. And so I lost it. So, yeah, FidoNet's full of politics. I don't even know, are they still around? They still do anything?
Yes.
They're just an internet domain now, right? Something,
no.
FidoNet.org, I mean, you can email.
The Denton Area FidoNet's Association is still meeting monthly.
Wow.
Steve Quarella is the current region coordinator for this area.
So Mike Masterson was the Austin mm-hmm. hub. I don't know where he is today, but... You know, 1:382/1, you know.
Do you remember the PK ARC versus
oh, yeah.
PK ZIP thing?
Yeah, remember that. That was a big deal.
What was your opinion of it?
Well, so the story I remember is C came out with ARC, a software company called C, with this compression thing, ARC, and then Phil Katz came out with a better version of ARC. Did the same thing, but it was faster, I guess. And so they sued him. And then meanwhile, he was working on this new thing on the side called ZIP that was way better than ARC, faster, smaller. And so by the time they won, and they I think they did win in the end, everybody was using ZIP because all the sysops were against ARC. And so nobody used ARC anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, like the small guy against the company. I don't think C was probably that big at the time, but it seemed like it.
Did you, did you perceive any of the arguments going by or any of that stuff with it? I mean, did you feel a need to switch to get away from ARC?
I just thought ZIP was better. I mean, just for technically better, you know, faster and smaller. That was really all I cared about.
What influence did War Games have on you?
It just made me want to, you know, hack, I guess. I mean, I don't know. You know, he dialed in and he wanted to play those games or whatever. And I mean, I didn't want to dial in a NORAD, but, you know, just anything. It didn't really matter. Actually, I did want to change my grades, like everybody probably. And so I found some War Dialer and started scanning my school. I didn't find anything. I don't even think they had a computer at that time, but yeah, I'm in suspense. God, you know, 6 months trying to do that, no luck. Mm-hmm. I ended up finding some system that the schools used to borrow the film strips or something. So,
well, that's something.
Something, not what I wanted.
I keep separating your time with PBSs from the early 80s to the early 90s because the style of boards are different. I mean, you know, lots more speed, a little more, larger base of people, so there's like a greater expansion of them, you know, really between those two. But is there anything about boards that you think people have lost knowledge of? Like, just people just don't know and don't remember, and the people who use it now don't know and remember with the internet, that you think they should know?
Like how long it took to load up a page, you know, 300 baud. I mean, you sit there and wait for it to go like this. People don't know that. I mean, they think, I guess the web pages are slow if you have a modem now, but you know, you're getting images and all that. What else? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you have websites that are kind of message forums and kind of a community, but a lot of boards were like a community. You know, everybody, you didn't know each other in person, but you know, you knew each other on the board. And I don't know, nothing specific though.
Okay, that's probably fine.